What defines a person? What defines a race of people? Sport is the greatest common denominator across all walks of life. When you think of New Zealand, their All Blacks rugby team is the first thing that comes to mind. Likewise, Australia and cricket, or England and soccer. Each is defined by one major characteristic, and more often than not, it's a sporting one. Here in Ireland, it's Gaelic games, and in Kerry, it's football. Now in its third century, the All-Ireland Senior Football Championship is long since regarded as the greatest sporting prize this country has to offer. No one has won it more times than Kerry. 36. And up until now, nobody has told the story of all of these successes. For the next 36 weeks, Radio Kerry will bring you the story of every one of those victories. From Dick Fitzgerald and the men who, over a century ago, laid the foundations for the kingdom's footballing future, through to Joe Barrett and his four-in-a-row winning team of the 1920s and 1930s, the two Micos, O'Dwyer and O'Connell, and Johnny Cullity, whose triumphs spanned three decades, the glory years of the 1970s and 1980s, the Renaissance men of 1997, and the history makers of the new millennium. We'll bring the past to life and recreate the most memorable moments in the county's history as we celebrate what is for Kerry people the greatest day.
Greatest Day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams.
Episode 2 of The Greatest Day tells the tale of 1904. If the kingdom were to achieve title number 2, Cork and Dublin were among the hurdles they would have to overcome. Throughout this programme, we'll be reproducing extracts from the Kerry Sentinel newspaper throughout that campaign. Voiced by Gary O'Sullivan.
Part 1.
For the 1904 season, Kerry were backboned by the nucleus of the squad that eventually got the better of Kildare in 1903. However, by virtue of the fact that they had yet to face London, the Kingdom did not begin their 1904 championship campaign as All-Ireland winners. From 1900 to 1903, there were home and away All-Ireland finals, whereby the home All-Ireland winners would each year play London. Elsewhere in the world at the time, William S. Kellogg set up the Battle Creek Toasted Cornflake Company. Irish-born doctor Thomas John Bernardo died. In the second half of the 19th century, he had set up over 100 institutions for deprived children. The first express train ran from London to Dublin via Fishguard in Wales. Most, if not all, aspects of football in the first decade of the last century are vastly different to the game as it is today. Take, for example, goalposts. Denny Breen, speaking to the Irish press of 1963, described how,
"If a present-day follower of the code were to find himself in a Gaelic pitch in those days, he might think, judging from the shape of the goalposts, that the GAA had come to some sort of compromise with what are now banned games. The goalposts consisted of a similar framework to present-day soccer posts, with what were known as the points posts standing on each side of them. They were roughly the same height as present-day uprights."
Pictures from that era depict, as Breen called them, points posts, akin to the outside posts in Australian rules. Owen Curry's Illustrated History of the GAA detailed that points could be scored over the soccer-style posts and between the points posts on either side of the goal. Also, nets were not yet introduced to the game. The 1904 season for Kerry began 2 weeks after the Kingdom defeated Kildare in the 1903 Championship home final second replay, and a fortnight before taking on London in the 1903 final proper. In between those matches, a Kerry-led Munster team played in the Railway Shield, losing out to Leinster. It seems the post-All-Ireland final celebrations were taking their toll.
"The explanation of the defeat is simple. The Kerrymen had evidently been jubilating over their magnificent success on the previous Sunday against Kildare. One of the players must have seen two balls during the match. That was bad enough, but he invariably made frantic efforts to get possession of the second, the one that wasn't there."
Fortunately, the celebrations were out of the system for the Munster opener against Cork. Kerry met the Rebels in the 1904 Championship in the last week of October 1905. Kerry cruised to a 1-4 to no score victory, just as considering the circumstances surrounding the fixture. The Kerry man of July 22nd, 1905, reporting on the fortnightly meeting of the county board, told of Kerry receiving a walkover against Cork, who were now appealing. The kingdom were not impressed by the actions of their near neighbours. The Kerry man noted how the county board meeting accused Cork of resorting to their old discreditable and unsuccessful dodge of lodging an illegal and frivolous objection. The Kerry man went on to state how the meeting was told that one of Cork's arguments was that their championships were not finished. However, Kerry was in exactly the same position, and if Cork could not finish their championships owing to their own fault, that was no reason why the inter-county contests should be delayed for years. 1 week ahead of the game finally taking place, the Kerry man was not letting up.
Kerry, after beating the Corkmen in all their objections before the Munster and Central Councils, and after having been awarded the football and hurling matches, have now refused to accept the walkover and have offered to play Cork, which offer, of course, has been accepted.
The game with Cork did go ahead. For this grudge encounter, the Kingdom could call on 15 of the side which downed Kildare at the third attempt. Eamon O'Neill, injured in the previous outing against Kildare, was replaced by Florence O'Sullivan. Con Ryan played in goals in place of Paddy Dillon. Once the sides took to the field, Kerry taught their great rivals a footballing lesson. No doubt that Kerry were inspired by the events leading up to the encounter.
The kick-out was in Kerry's favour, who rushed in splendid fashion. Dempsey at Cork goal was most faultly, and the major score went down to Kerry. From the delivery, a scrum ensued, and Fitzgerald fisted in a minor for Kerry. A fierce tussle raged for some minutes close on Kerry's goal line. The latter's back fought determinedly in defence of their posts, and Cork had to retire to the quarter mark. The leather travelled up and down the field with lightning-like rapidity until T. Fitzgerald, with the aid of a magnificent dribble along Cork's right wing, centred beautifully, but the shot for a major failed.
At the short whistle, Kerry were ahead 1-1 to no score. They were good value for that lead. The Kingdom's dominance continued into the second period.
Kerry were going strong all the time. Kerry were not to be checkmated, and the brothers Gorman, backed up by Cassan and Kerwin, proved too formidable, and score after score became the order of the Kingdom side. The light was now fading, and the rain still falling unmercilessly, the players were handicapped to an enormous extent. At times it was not possible to sight the post with any degree of accuracy. The scores were being steadily compiled by Kerry, which had a most disheartening effect on the Cork representatives.
Kerry had tagged on 3 points in that second half, while Cork remained scoreless. Kerry prevailed by 1-4 to no score. A Munster final beckoned. Waterford were next up, and Kerry were forced to line out minus Castle Island's Roddy Kerwin and Tralee Mitchell's trio, Denny Curran, Jim O'Gorman and J.T. Fitzgerald. Killarney's Jay Doherty and Dennis O'Keefe, along with Tralee's PJ Cahill and John O'Sullivan, were all drafted in. In addition, Con Ryan of Tralee was replaced in goals by regular custodian, Killarney's Paddy Dillon. Waterford had worries of their own.
Opponents Clashmore laboured under a greater disadvantage owing to the unusual action of Waterford County Board and not allowing the champion team to effect their own selection. The result was that Clashmore had virtually to defend the honour of Waterford with their own players.
Despite their numerous changes, Kerry went into the tie as raging hot favourites. They were defending Munster and All-Ireland champions and among the fancies for this season's national crown. The Kingdom were to receive the shock of their lives in the provincial final, played at Cork Athletic Grounds in December 1905.
Frequent onslaughts were made on the Kerry posts. Waterford had a shot for the post, but the ball rebounded across the crossbar. A brilliant bit of play was shown by Rocket, who broke through all opposition, and Power lent timely aid with a splendid fly kick which found its way through the post, thus giving Waterford the initial honours. Waterford looked like repeating their success, but a free to Kerry improved the latter's position, and off a scramble they pulled off a nice point, bringing the team's level. A great rush by Waterford had the desired effect, Rocket adding the second minor. Kerry got a good chance in the next period of the game, but R. Fitzgerald missed what seemed an easy thing. The next feature of the play was some brilliant work along the right wing by Waterford. Kerry defended in great style when the situation seemed fraught with imminent peril. The half-time was reached with Waterford having much the better of the first period.
The score at the break did not reflect Waterford's superiority in that opening half. They held a slender advantage, 2 points to 1. Waterford extended the lead to 3 points to 1. But then...
From the send out, Kerry charged down, and their prospects of scoring looked extremely favourable. Duggan, however, frustrated very smartly, and Kerry retired to centre, from which they again attacked, this time with more success. Dee Fitzgerald sending through for a minor. Two chances were allowed to pass by Kerry, who soon after had their opponent's post at their mercy. Lynch being responsible for a fine performance, which added a further minor to Kerry.
The sides were now level at 3 points each. The issue was well and truly in the balance, as both sought to find a winner. A nervy finish ensued.
Waterford ought to have scored, but for Ducey's failure from an easy angle. Kerry's backs worked well, and their lines having been cleared, Gorman had a shot for goal, but lost, and Waterford followed suit.
At the end of normal time, the sides could not be separated, finishing at 3 points each. The issue of extra time arose.
The Kerry representatives were disposed to play for an extended period with a view to deciding the issue. It was proposed to play 15 minutes each way, but owing to the advanced hour of the evening, the Waterford men did not see their way to accede to the wish of their opponents.
Waterford's decision to decline the opportunity of extra time may well be due to the fact that, as Years of Glory pointed out,
there was a lot of tension in that second half, and the referee sent one of the Waterford players to the line before the end.
The greatest day. The story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group. Proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Part 2.
For the second outing against Waterford, Kerry could call on the services of three of the men who missed the drawn encounter. Denny Curran, Jim O'Gorman and J.T. Fitzgerald. The teams reconvened in Dungarvan in January 1906 in far from ideal conditions.
The field was dreadfully wet owing to the heavy rains. Rain fell incessantly for the first 20 minutes when it cleared up somewhat. Slipping during the match was frequent. At 3 o'clock the ball was thrown in and immediately Kerry got possession, and before 2 minutes had elapsed had placed a point to their credit, cleverly scored by Fitzgerald. Kerry had the best of it for the next 5 minutes, and a splendid kick by Lynch struck the goalpost and rebounded when the position was saved. In another few minutes, Waterford placed a point to their credit by Ducey, after which Rocket took for Waterford a 50 yards but failed to score. After 20 minutes play, Fitzgerald in a 50 yards scored another point for Kerry.
Half-time arrived with Kerry leading by 1 goal and 2 points to 1 point. Strangely, the match report carried no description of Kerry's first half goal. Many match reports of that era also omitted the identity of goal or point scorers. To recap, Kerry went into the second period with a 4-point advantage, 1 goal and 2 points to 1 point. The gap was soon extended.
5 minutes into the second half saw Kerry add another goal to their score. This goal was splendidly kicked by Lynch. With but 10 minutes to go, the chances of Waterford looked a little brighter when they made a point. Kerry once missed a splendid chance, but towards the close of play put on another point and at the call of time came out victorious.
The result was 2-3 to 2 points in Kerry's favour.
Waterford played with much spirit, but from the start it was evident that they lacked the combination, which was a distinguishing feature of the play by the Kerry team. Myers for Kerry did well, but Lynch deserved all the credit he received, while Fitzgerald was almost certain to place to advantage every chance that offered.
On the beaten Waterford team was Percy Kerwin, a brother of Kerry defender Roddy Kerwin. Roddy missed those games against Waterford, but returned to the Kerry defence for the latter stages of the championship. Legend has it that Roddy Kerwin was not keen to line out against his native county. However, the records show he played against them in the 1903 season. In an interview with the Irish Press in 1963, Denny Breen spoke of Roddy Kerwin, the bank official from Kilmacthomas in Waterford, and how unusual it was for a bank official to be playing, and I quote, the games of the Gael. The Kerry man, meanwhile, was likening the Kingdom side to one of the most famous names in sport, from that day to this one.
If we take the Kerry victories for some considerable time back, one is justified in designating the team the All-Whites, the opposite colour being that applied to the invincible New Zealanders. The All-Ireland champions have obtained yet another victory, and this is so soon after the Christmas holidays. This is a demonstration
that they still are the best in form and will continue to sustain that form so long as good health and unity are evident.
In a post note to the Kerry versus Waterford replay, the Sentinel explained how, prior to the game, the Kerry players had a meeting and adopted the following resolution to send their best wishes to the President of the County Board, Eugene O'Sullivan, for his forthcoming contest for the representation of East Kerry in Parliament. O'Sullivan was unsuccessful. There are different theories as to the origin of Kerry's wearing of the green and gold. We revealed last week how they had worn those colours when defeating Kildare in the second replay of the 1903 All-Ireland Home Championship final. However, Kerry football book Princes of Pigskin says it was 1913 before the green and gold was, as Princes of Pigskin put it, rubber-stamped as the county colours. But where exactly did the green and gold come from? There have been different theories down the years. All of them have one common theme, that the colours were in fact borrowed and subsequently adopted. Local journalist Jimmy Darcy this month publishes his book Forged in Green and Gold, 125 Years of Kerry GAA. In it he offers up that the green and gold originated in Waterford. Kerry had travelled to the county in or around 1903 to participate in an invitational tournament. They journeyed without the Tralee Mitchells jerseys, which the kingdom adorned, as Mitchells held the tag of county champions. In those days, the club which won the county championship had the honour of representing its county in the All-Ireland series. Darcy goes on to state that Waterford native Roddy Kerwin, full back for Kerry, called upon a local club to borrow their green and gold strip. Down the years, it has been documented in many quarters that Kerry received a bye to the final that season. Not so. Some outlets at the time had, rather confusingly, the Kerry v Cavan match billed as the interprovincial tie of the All-Ireland championship. Well, this semi did take place on May 6th, 1906. Denny Cassan and Billy Lynch did not line out against Cavan. Roddy Kerwin and Tom O'Sullivan did. Kerry railroaded their northern opposition, as the Kerry man reported.
J.T. Fitzgerald shot the first point for the kingdom. Roddy Kerwin came to the relief with a fine kick, and Dick Fitzgerald, taking over, sent between the posts. In the next tussle, a point per John Buckley. It was Ulster's turn now, and Kilronan registered, to which Munster replied with a goal by Dick Fitzgerald. A feature of Ulster's performance was their fielding, which was at times smart. It, however, failed to make any tangible impression on the Munster combination.
Kerry led 1-3 to 1 point at half-time. An early second-half strike put the game beyond Cavan.
P.J. Cahill was not to be denied and made most of the chance offered by pulling off a goal. Every attack was successful, and while Munster steadily enlarged their account, Ulster failed to make any addition to theirs.
Kerry finished with a tally of 4 goals and 10 points, with Cavan only registering a single point all afternoon. The Kerryman newspaper felt,
"The Cavan men were most unfortunate in having such a team as Kerry opposing them. Cavan led pretty well in the first half, but on reversing positions, Kerry scored repeatedly. It is not wise to count on chickens before they are hatched, but one might be pardoned for thinking that the Kerry boys, judging by their performance against Cavan, will once again be the champions of Ireland. Many were of opinion that the team was not at present time in the pink of condition, but those looking at Sunday's match thought differently."
Mission accomplished for Kerry. Another All-Ireland final appearance secured. The kingdom were to meet Leinster opposition once more. This time, however, it was not Kildare who they would face, but Dublin. Dublin had accounted for Mayo in their semi-final, 8 points to 1-3. Denny Breen, in that interview with the Irish Press, documented the training regime of his era.
"Players were expected to get themselves fit and never failed. Many is the time I went into one of the fields at the back of the town and did a couple of laps. That, with gymnastic exercises, was as much as the individual did. We kept ourselves fit by match practice. Approaching a big game, our employers would allow us to leave work early on Tuesday and Friday evenings. The team then travelled to Killarney, where the probables played the possibles. This was as much collective training as we did."
Unfortunately for him, Denny Breen was one of four members of the 1903 winning side who were omitted for the decider this time around. Denny Cassan and Billy Lynch were two of the others. The fourth was Thady O'Gorman, captain during the previous campaign's triumph. Thady may have been denied a second All-Ireland medal, but his legacy would be seen in decades to come. Thady's son Jimmy became a multiple All-Ireland medal holder, while Thady's nephew Bill scored the goal that saved Kerry in the 1926 final. The 13 others from 1903 all started that 1904 decider. They were to be joined in the lineup by John O'Sullivan, PJ Cahill, Con Murphy and Tom O'Sullivan. Cahill had been a used sub in the 1903 win over London. As per Kerry's All-Ireland final victory of 1903, the 1904 decider also took place 2 years beyond its actual date. Opinion was divided as to who was fancied to claim the honours. In some quarters, Kerry were tagged as underdogs ahead of the showdown with Dublin, which was played in July 1906.
The Metropolitans, after their brilliant victory over Kilkenny in the Leinster final, and the consistent course of training they had gone through, were much fancied to pull off the honours of the day.
Years of Glory, however, depicted Kerry as favourites due to the fact that they had so many of the previous season's All-Ireland winning team. Years of Glory felt the tag of favourite was strengthened owing to Kerry's victory over Mayo in the replay of the Croke Cup final in March. Irrespective of who were the favourites, everybody feared that the inclement conditions would sour the spectacle. Just like the Waterford replay, the weather was not favourable to the men from the kingdom. The game took place.
Under weather conditions of the most inclement nature, the match was begun in a drenching downpour and Kerry played towards the Black Rock end with the wind in their favour. After some interchanges at halfway, T. Sullivan Kerry had to retire having received a bad kick in the leg. Kerry fouled and Lynch took the free, sending in the opening score. McCarthy saved and transferred to Stack, the latter sent to Buckley, and Gorman's attack resulted in a point for Kerry. From the send-out, Kerry's forwards played a dashing game and off a desperate rush, a second minor went down to Kerry. Kerry missed a score by inches. It was a possible point, but the Kerry man had endeavoured to improve on the opportunity by attempting the major score, which proved too much for him. The kick-out left play in Dublin's grounds, and soon after, Dublin were penalised. Kerwin did the needful with a point for Kerry. Dublin's prospects were once again looking bright with another free, but Maurice McCarthy, who'd been playing a marvellously fine game for Kerry, neutralised in the nick of time. Brennan, following up a smart performance, landed a point for Dublin. To this, Sullivan of Tralee replied with a point. A 50 yards for Dublin went without result, and Kerwin also failed to improve on a like advantage given his side.
It meant that at the turnaround, Kerry led by double scores, 4-2. As could be expected, Dublin took the game to their opponents from the onset of the second half.
Dublin rushed from the restart, and it was any price in favour of a score for Dublin. Maurice McCarthy frustrated with a cleverly executed flying kick. From the centre, Kerwin and Cahill proved the tower of strength to the kingdom. Some fouls for overholding the ball was given against both sides, in one of which the Kerry line was not responsive and a save score was lost. Though Dublin continued to fight on bravely, the Kerry men had settled down well and towards the last 5 minutes of the full period had failed to make any appreciable impression in the scoring direction.
The sole score of the second half was a point by Dick Fitzgerald. A 5-2 victory meant Austin Stack was the second Kerry captain of an All-Ireland winning team.
Kerry, going strong, proceeded to give an exhibition of that dash and determination which counts for so much in the final issue. With 15 minutes of the contest had expired, it was seen that the combination of the Kerry side were superior to that of their opponents, and Kerry's forwards were too much for Dublin. Their trickery-centred movements were apparently more than Dublin had bargained for. Dick Fitzgerald played a particularly brilliant game, while Stack, O'Gorman, Kerwin, Cahill and Sullivan got through a lot of useful work.
The greatest day. The story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group. Proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Part 3.
A final score of 5-2 in an All-Ireland football final was low scoring by today's standards. However, not so back then, especially when two sides of the calibre of Kerry and Dublin met. Father Tom Looney.
A lot of games were very low scoring because, first of all, the game was a lot slower than it is now. The pigskin was a very heavy, heavy. I played with the leather pigskin ourselves. When that ball got older and when it got larger and it got heavier, and a wet day then, of course, it was a ton weight altogether, you know. So you must say, but some of those games, for instance, in the semi-final of 1904, Kerry scored 4 goals and 10 points. To Cavan's 1 point, so that wasn't bad. In the replay with Waterford, Kerry scored 2 goals and 3 points.
Yet again, Dick Fitzgerald had come up trumps for the kingdom, a common occurrence. In Raymond Smith's Football Immortals book, one of Dick Fitz's future teammates testified to this. Castle Gregory's Pat Aeroplane O'Shea recalled how the year of Kerry's All-Ireland title defence was the first time he saw Dick Fitz in action.
A mere stripling then, he yet displayed all the coolness and skill which made score-getting look easy. These qualities he retained during his entire playing career, even when he became a much heavier man and less speedy. He was the most unselfish forward I ever saw, always parting with the ball to any of his forwards better placed. Many was the occasion that he pulled a game out of the fire with seconds to go. Normally joyful and witty, he became serious and responsible when a big match was in the offering. Our champion and guardian, looking after our comfort with fatherly care and making sure that if we worked hard, we also relaxed. On the field, he was always the captain.
That Kerry success of 1904 is rarely spoken of, being overshadowed by the previous season's victory, largely due to the trilogy against Kildare. GAA commentator Micheála Mura Hurthic feels that's understandable.
It was only a follow-up. You know, there's something very special for any county to win for the first time. That one in particular is never forgotten. Let it be a good game or a bad game, it is the first and it remains the first forever. So 1904 certainly was overshadowed. It was the same players, more or less. They had established themselves by winning the 1903 title. 1904 was just another one added onto it. And it was the beginning, if you like, of a unique run. Every decade since then, Kerry have managed to win in All-Ireland.
The Kerryman newspaper was pleased to report that Brain had won out against Braun.
While physically the Dublin men looked the abler team, they could not at all compare with the able tactics of Kerry. The news of the victory was received with the greatest enthusiasm at home and abroad. It proves that when the Kerry boys practice and combine, they can sweep any combination before them.
PF's 1945 book, Kerry's Football Story, detailed how, after a quarter of an hour's play, it was evident the Kerrymen were the superior. They handled the slippery ball better and kicked it greater length. Kerry's post-match celebrations could not begin yet, however. Mention has already been made of Tom O'Sullivan having to retire early in proceedings. However, the extent of what he had to subsequently endure merits further explanation.
A member of the Kerry 17 met with a pretty bad injury to the leg almost at the start of the match, and he ought to have received more humane treatment than he had meted out to him. The accident occurred during the first 5 minutes of the match. The man was removed to the dressing room in intense pain, and there he was allowed to remain until the match was concluded, when he was removed on the shoulders of some of the members of his team. It was then proposed to put him in an ordinary hackney car. Wiser counsels, however, prevailed, and the Cork Fire Brigade ambulance was requested and was quickly in attendance.
GAA historian Father Tom Looney explains just how O'Sullivan was taken from the dressing room before being placed in an ambulance.
Long Tom O'Sullivan, the game has been played in Cork, and he had an unfortunate accident. His leg was broken, and I suppose they hadn't backup, they hadn't ambulances. I don't know, he was put into the dressing room. And they had no stretcher, so they took a door off the dressing room. They placed him on the door, and then they marched into the hospital through the public streets. You know, you can imagine there were no tracksuits at home. There was very little by way of backup. A lot of players probably had to pay their own way to go to these matches even, you know.
Roddy Kerwin was central to Kerry's successes of the early 1900s. The Waterford man's exploits on the football field saw him earn the nickname Stonewall. Joe Mura Hurthic, co-author of Kerry football book Princes of Pigskin, explains how that came to be.
He would be recognised as a real standout figure in Kerry football, purely maybe by virtue of the fact that he wasn't a Kerry man at all. He was a Waterford man who came working in Castle Island in the bank, and out of that he got his place on the Kerry team. He came from a noted family of athletes. His brother Percy was a great athlete and won 3 gold medals in the AA championships and competed in the Papal Games in Rome, while Roddy himself was a great athlete in the 110 yards and 220 yards. But Roddy Kerwin was one of the staunch defenders, along with the likes of Maurice McCarthy. He was the real bulwark of the defence, and out of that came the nickname Roddy Stonewall Kerwin, and it stuck ever since to cement his name in the folklore of Kerry footballer. I suppose purely by virtue of the fact, apart from the fact that he was a great footballer, also by virtue of the fact that he wasn't a Kerry man. He came into Kerry, he was embraced by Kerry football people and won his All-Irelands after that.
The Kerryman newspaper went on to state its belief that if the side stuck together, there would be no obstacle to the county winning again in 1905. Kerry came within one match of granting that particular wish, but surrendered their title at the final hurdle, going down 1-7 to 5 points against Kildare in that 1905 decider, played in 1907.
Nonetheless, the kingdom's efforts of 1904 in securing its second All-Ireland crown afforded the poets and balladeers the opportunity to honour the county's heroes. GAA commentator Mihola Murrahertig says such offerings were commonplace.
It was indeed, because no radio even at that time. They had to wait until people came home from the matches to get an account of the game. And then, of course, a huge, huge demand for the likes of the Kerrymen, because the ordinary household did not get a daily newspaper in those days. So they depended on word of mouth, let it be in song or ordinary prose, to get the accounts of the heroes and all that. And those ballads were very generous to the opposition as well.
It was not until 1913 that football became a 15-a-side game. Up until then, it had been 17-a-side, whilst for much of the 1880s, it was 21-a-side. When Kerry won that 1904 All-Ireland final, they would have lined out as follows. Goalkeeper, in front of him a full-back, who in turn would have two fellow defenders flanking him, albeit that duo would be slightly further out the pitch. The same applied with the centre-back and two half-backs. Each team had four men patrolling the centre-field area, two more towards the sideline, and two in front of them in the middle. The half-forwards would be three in a row as per today. Ahead of them were two men, with the 17th member filling a sort of full-forward role. All-Ireland's may be one on the field of play, but the role of the administrator should never be forgotten. Certainly this applied in the early 1900s. The reforming of the Tralee Mitchells Club in 1900 was vital to the back-to-back successes of 1903 and 1904. The role of Thomas F. O'Sullivan cannot be overstated either. In 1900, Listolman O'Sullivan became secretary of the resurrected Kerry County Board. The board had been defunct for nigh on 2 years. O'Sullivan and his fellow board members set about rectifying the neglect of recent seasons, and they succeeded in some style. 16 teams participated in the county championship of 1902, and 18 teams took part in 1903. Tralee Mitchells won each of those two championships, which subsequently led to the kingdom's opening All-Ireland triumphs. Thomas F. O'Sullivan was responsible for the first ever history of the GAA in 1916.
You asked what's the secret of Kerry, and often I wished that I knew. 'Twill doubtless seem odd, though born on the sod, that question has puzzled me too. You see the lad work in the meadow, as he tosses the hay without rest, and longs for the lengthening shadow, as the sun slowly moves towards the west. Then he'll hark to the thud of a football, and things more important must yield, for nothing must stay in a Kerry lad's way when the ball bounces high on the field. A thirst as he has for tradition, a rendezvous with his grandsires, who planted the ken of a mission that drives and demands and inspires. He knows he must strive to be worthy of heroes of whom he looks back. He knows he must merit the right to inherit the virtues of Gorman and Stack. No wealth does a Kerry lad envy, but give him a broad field of green, and a ball that in flight must commune at its height with the spirit of Kerwin and Breen. Fitzgerald, Costello and Dillon, McCarthy and so many more, no page can contain the hallowed domain of Kerry's vast legions of yore. When a Kerryman stands on a mountain and looks towards the wild rolling seas, he's ranging his eyes on the broad vast horizon, emblazoned by stars just like these. Their passing beyond has befit him, and no Kerryman needs to be told that a legacy grand they have left him that's fashioned of green and of gold. He honours the gift that is hallowed, as honoured twas by his forebearers, and he knows that each move must be destined to prove that he's fit for the colour he wears. 'Tis a Kerryman's clear understanding that when those colours to his true, he's wearing a mantle demanding the best that a mortal can do. You asked what's the secret of Kerry, and I've tried to answer your call, but things I have told are so true and so old that they aren't a secret at all.
You've been listening to The Greatest Day, a 36-part series documenting the story of Kerry's All-Ireland Senior Football Championship victories. The Greatest Day was presented by John Drummy, written by Joe O'Mahony, and researched and produced by the Radio Kerry Sports team. This programme was made with the support of the Sound and Vision Broadcast Funding Scheme, a BCI initiative.
The Greatest Day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group.
proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Next week on The Greatest Day.
Before Kerry had even kicked a ball in the 1909 Championship, they had already lost an All-Ireland final.
Referee Nocton betrayed an incompetence and an ignorance of the rules, which were amazing, and beyond a shadow of doubt, lost Kerry the match.
Kerry refused to accept the Championship, as they had not won it on the playing field.
While holidaying in his native Kilgarvan, he played with the village team, which was not affiliated.
Then, with a little under 10 minutes remaining, came the decisive score.
Skinner, who receiving and coming on with lightning speed, simply mesmerised the Cork custodian.
An apparently frivolous Cork objection to the makeup of Kerry.
It is in keeping with the usual Cork tactics. Conduct of this kind does not speak well for any county. Tom Costello, taking the kick, sent the ball to the mouth of the goal, and Skinner put in Kerry's second major. Familiar faces were to be met in nearly all the public thoroughfares, and the general air of jubilation proved the boys were there for a purpose. The irrepressible Dick swerved clear and shot past to Skinner, whose shot shook the net.
The title champions of Ireland may have been won on the pitch, but it then had to be secured off it. Kerry survived Dublin's call at Central Council for the Kingdom to be expelled from the association for 5 years.